Hi, and welcome back to another episode of Cosmic Echo, a Tale Eater podcast. In this podcast, we are applying a scientific viewpoint to the strange and bizarre phenomenon that happens in our lives when we sleep in altered states. So we discuss things that are a little bit strange in this podcast, so hope you have an open mind and are willing to listen. So in this episode, we're going to be talking to a man named Dr. Tactical, who uses salvia in order to facilitate lucid dreaming. In the last episode, we talked about lucid dreaming and with Ryan Hurd and how you can learn skills to actually have lucid dreams. Well, in this episode, we're going a bit different, and we're applying some plant material in order to cause us to actually be aware why we're dreaming. In this episode, we just want to remind you that we do not support the use of any of these substances that Dr. Tocnicol talks about. However, that is up to you if you do that and the legality of the plant in your area. So just keep that in mind. And another thing, if you do enjoy this podcast and would like to continue hearing our podcast online, then we'd ask that if you can, please support us at our Patreon page, and you can visit our taleeaters.com website and go to podcast and then find the link there to support us. So without further ado, let's get to the interview.
Dr. Tactical, thank you so much for joining us today.
And pleasure to be with you guys.
So first off, how did you get into lucid dreaming?
Yeah, good question. You know, I'm a lifelong dream enthusiast. I've read on the subject of dreaming. As I explained to people when I was younger, I kind of delved into dream interpretation and that sort of, you know, what was understood and what was interesting to people back then. At some point in my late 20s, I had a couple off-the-cuff lucid dreams. I knew enough about dreaming to know what they were. And I honed in on the Burgess work and read Ewald and exploring the world of lucid dreaming. And, you know, basically dived into the traditional Western perspective on how to induce lucids. Definitely earned myself a couple, but it was hard work and I didn't make great progress. And I kind of lost interest in it. Now, ironically, going back to the salvia angle, basically when I discovered salvia in my mid to late 30s, it reminded me of lucid dreaming. And it kind of got me back into that whole mode of exploring lucid dreaming and salvia and the potential connection between the two. That's kind of what got me involved.
Well, that's great. So before the podcast, you submitted us some preliminary material. And also, you have a great article on lucidconsciousness.com where you speak about salvia and facilitating lucid dreaming. So could you talk a little bit about how salvia maybe might prepare one for inducing a wild or that transition state?
Sure. You know, wilds are kind of the holy grail of lucid dreaming. And I always tell people, if you're a beginner, you know, get into dills first and work toward wake initiated lucid dreams. But with that said, one thing that always struck me as interesting and has definitely helped me, I'm quite sure, is that, you know, when we talk about using salvia and we talk about, you know, using maybe a couple powerful, you know, hits of a good standardized extract. So we all know what that feels like, and it's very intense. It ramps you up from 0 to 60 in a couple seconds, and it's hard to maintain awareness. It's, you know, and you've got to learn that transitional give and take of letting it take over and letting it show you something and not losing your awareness in that process. Well, you know, I maintain that that's very similar to the transition in awake-initiated lucid dream. You know, whether it's hypnagogic imagery driven or whether it's a transition via the vibrational state, you know, that process of traveling from here to there is similar. So I make the point in the article that, you know, salvia is an interesting tool in learning how to negotiate that transition. But because, you know, when we get into trying to learn how to wild, it's tough. I mean, frankly speaking, you can only do it after, you know, some number of hours of sleep, because it's hard to go from a wakeful state to stage 5 REM without having the proper neurotransmitter balance. So you can't do it, right? Right? I mean, you can't do it. You can't do it during the day. You probably can't do it upon going to sleep. So, you know, I've kind of used salvia, and I make the suggestion in the article to basically use it as a tool to learn how to make a transition from a wakeful state to a visionary one. And that's definitely helped me leverage that knowledge and that experience with my wilds and lucid dreams.
In comparison to salvia, how would you say that other lucid dreaming supplements have compared in your, you know, quest for lucidity?
You know, it's we're comparing apples and oranges. I'll tell you what I mean by that. You know, when we talk about other lucid dreaming sups, you know, we're talking about things that have a more direct facilitation of lucid dreaming. I mean, you know, let's talk about galantamine as being the great example. I mean, galantamine works because you're basically waking up the left cortex of your brain. Your logical processing is turned back on, and it basically biases the brain such that you're unlikely to slip into non-REM sleep from a wakeful state. And so for all those reasons, it facilitates lucid dreaming. I mean, if you look at salvia, if I maintain it facilitates lucid dreaming, but for a whole different set of reasons.
Okay.
Because it facilitates an intimacy with visionary states, because the analogy with the wake initiated lucid dream transition, it's a different set of reasons.
So what can you tell us about a cranial electrostimulation in relation to lucid dreaming?
Sure. You know, I'm pretty well versed on different ways to get lucid in dreams. And certainly I've got a very technical background. I've done a lot of engineering. I've got a lot of patents to my name. You know, I've done some interesting technical things. So when I did get back into lucid dreaming, you know, I really dived into the lucid dream supplement theory, and that's pretty well fleshed out. I mean, you know, read Yushak's book, and you pretty much know what's going on there. And there's been experimentation and some discovery beyond that, but that's a pretty good summary. And of course, you know, you read a lot about different brainwave entrainment techniques and different ways to facilitate lucid dreaming. It dawned on me that while, you know, different brainwave entrainment methods like binaural beats are interesting, I have yet to have anyone really, you know, claim that it's the end all be all with regard to dream, you know, lucid dream enhancement and capability. I got involved, and why I got involved in this might be even more interesting than the result itself. But I got involved in cranial electrostimulation as just another way to explore different states of consciousness, different points along the consciousness continuum. And I had some theories as to, you know, what might be interesting brain states to tap to facilitate lucidity. Now, cranial electrostimulation is way more powerful than binaural beats. It's more direct. You're passing a microcurrent across your brain. That sounds scary, but it's pretty well understood technology, actually. We're only talking about we're talking about microcurrents. We're talking about, you know, a milliamp at best. You know, when we talk about you know, taking somebody out with electricity, we're talking about an amp or so. So we're talking about trivial currents, but it does have a very profound effect. And you know, there are electrochemical signatures associated with lucidity. And I've played around with a technique, a signal and protocol that is quite positive toward lucid dream induction. You know, certainly for me, on the order of galantamine, but a different overall effect and result. And, you know, we could dig into that if you're curious.
Absolutely. So, I mean, is this something similar to, like, Persinger's God helmet, so to speak?
Well, you've got me. I've never heard of that one.
Well, there's this researcher up in Canada who has what's known as the God helmet that sounds very similar to what you're stating, where they put sort of this it almost looks like a football helmet, but it's hooked up with electrodes, and they pop it on the person's head, and they're able to facilitate. I think the one that I hear the most about is at least a sensed presence. They can kind of adjust the frequencies in order to have the user feel someone behind them or around them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you mentioned binaural beats. Can you tell us, how did you get into Monroe, and what is your opinion of binaural beats in their effect for facilitating lucid dreaming?
Let me see if I could pick that question apart. I think there's two questions.
Oh, sorry.
that's cool. As far as binaural beats are concerned, I got into binaurals around the same time I discovered salvia and, you know, visionary states. And, you know, binaural beats are, you know, conceptually simple. Basically, you're trying to drive your brain to a brain state, typically lower brain states in the delta or theta range. The problem, of course, is that we don't hear those frequencies. So they play a little trick where they play two higher frequency beats in the left and right ears, and the brain kind of adds them up and takes the difference. And you could do the math. You could do the calculus. It's really easy to show that you get an envelope that has essentially a brain state that's the difference between the two frequencies. And, you know, there's definitely evidence that the brain will begin to track that frequency, and you'll lower the average electrical spectral response in the brain. Now, that's interesting because, you know, the brain is an electrochemical device, and when we talk about consciousness continuum, which is a term that Monroe liked to throw around, I mean, I'm a fan of the conjecture, the theory that, you know, when we're in this wakeful state, we're tuned to this reality. But there are other realities, and they have physicality in some sense. And, you know, that binaural beats or other brainwave entrainment methods, lucid dreaming, they're all different ways to experience different points along that continuum. I'd gotten into it, you know, a number of years ago. It's roughly similar technology as the Hemisync stuff. You know, Monroe's Hemisync stuff is all binaural beat driven. And, you know, they've got their notion of focus states, and we'll probably get into that later in the conversation. But, you know, I'll leave you with the thought, and then we'll see where we want to go with it. You know, I maintain that, you know, what's interesting is not, you know, pursuing one thing, lucid dreaming, or another, a salvia vision, or different brain states, or different psi experiments. You know, I maintain that, you know, there's little bits and pieces of knowledge and insight to gain from all these different things. And when you start to explore different areas, they tend to facilitate exploration in others, and you start to form a picture. And that's kind of where I am in my personal interest and my personal research.
Okay. So what kind of picture are you starting to form after these experiments?
I'll cut to the chase, and then maybe we'll unravel it. You know, going back to Monroe, of course, you pointed him out, and I've definitely been a fan of his work. Frankly speaking, I didn't even discover Monroe's work until like May or June of last year. I mean, I was certainly aware of him. I knew he was sort of one of the main people who kind of were proponents of the out-of-body experience, and he was sort of a forerunner in that area. So I was generally aware of his work. But, ultimately, there have been interesting parallels between his experiences and my own that predated my even understanding anything about him or what some of his conclusions were. I find myself asking the question, you know, there are certain insights I've been having and certain discoveries I've made, and there seems to be almost a trickle effect. And the trickle effect almost seems to imply that something or someone wants to maintain your interest, wants to maintain your discovery along this process. And that was very similar to Monroe's experience. And, you know, in Monroe's case, I'll try to make this all make sense. And, you know, his work is quite involved, obviously. In Monroe's case, ultimately what he discovered was one of his guides in the out-of-body state was effectively, you know, him, you know, effectively, or you know, another manifestation of himself, or stated somewhat differently, probably a member of his Eye There cluster, you know. And, you know, what that means essentially is if you believe in reincarnation, upon your death, if you have another earthly existence, you know, there's another physical incarnation of yourself. And ultimately, there's going to be, you know, over time, many physical incarnations. And of course, if you know, breaking out of this four-dimensional space, if you believe that time is nonlinear in some of these other dimensional spaces, well, your physical existence is nonlinear, which means that even if you exist now, there might be versions of what you will become in the future, presently. Hopefully that all made sense. And he defined that as an idea cluster. It's basically a collection of entities associated with the physical incarnation of yourself. And certainly, I'll make one final point, and then I'll let you dig into it and try to make sense of it. So ultimately, he had concluded that a certain entity in his eye there cluster was basically helping him to understand things and discover things, for various purposes. And that's kind of where I am in my discovery process. I feel that these discoveries are driven by something potentially larger than myself. And there seems to be purpose, and perhaps the purpose is reuniting with the cluster. Hopefully that's a very condensed version. Hopefully that made sense.
Sure. And it reminds me a little bit about something you read or that you wrote about Tibetan dream yoga as well, of kind of getting into these states to maintain perhaps a presence for a future incarnation. Is that correct?
Well, what I find interesting about dream yoga, and I tied it into the whole use of salvia. I mean, dream yoga is interesting because, as I understand it, and I am not an expert, I haven't been sequestered up in the mountains of Tibet and, studied with the monks, but I understand the fundamentals. And the fundamentals are they leverage lucid dream space to destroy negative karmic threads and better understand the true nature of their mind. That's the fundamentals. They believe if they better understand the true nature of their mind in this visionary lucid state where they get deeper and deeper into what, their existence really is, that at the point of death, rather than get sucked into another earthly manifestation and forget who they were or what they were in the past, they will get to some next state. And, there are different planes that are defined in their, I guess you would call it religious beliefs. I'm not sure if the word religion applies to that paradigm precisely, but we'll use that
term.
Sure. And, so basically it's not that different than the Monroe model or even my own model that I'm alluding to, where, there's perhaps such a thing as reincarnation, and learning how to negotiate the out-of-body state gives you insights into how to direct your reincarnation or your afterlife. It's interesting that different Eastern philosophies and Western philosophies potentially have overlap. That's interesting to me.
Absolutely, I completely agree. And along those lines too, of of the work that one does in the lucid state affecting the real world. You have done psi experiments, and can you explain a little bit about what your force transfer experiments are?
I'll back it up one so the whole story makes a heck of a lot more sense. And I'll back it up too, because I want the story to make sense and I want it to flow chronologically,
sure.
So to speak. I talked about, what if you were being guided by some entity within your eye there cluster. So, I've had a number of insights, and, my claim is I haven't worked that hard. certain insights came to me very easily, and they came to me in a salvia-induced state. And these were over time. First, the cranial electrostimulation idea came to me, which is really to say the frequencies to tap and the protocol to tap that might be interesting. And it essentially came to me in a visionary state. Or even more precisely, coming down from a visionary state and trying to assess, what that lesson was. Okay, and so basically, the whole cranial electrostimulation idea flowed from that process. In an analogous way, I'm very interested in psi phenomena. Certainly, I believe that using salvia opens up a person's conscious reception capabilities to psi information. There's very little question about that in my mind. So again, I leveraged salvia, really kind of accidentally. I was just, using it and basically gleaning insights and so forth. And I had an insight as to how I might construct a dream psi experiment. But, the interesting thing about dream psi is most researchers have leveraged non-lucid dreams because, leveraging lucid dreams is complex. You need a good lucid dreamer. You need to be able to induce
right.
that state. I'll give you the framework, and I'll tell you the result. The framework is pretty simple. When I have out-of-body experiences, I typically find myself in a replication of my real-world space. So if in my real-world space, waking reality space, I put out some what are called Zenner cards. So they're just three cards. They have different shapes, a star, a cross, and some squiggly lines. So I basically randomize them, place them face down, put them on the kitchen counter, induce an out-of-body experience. Lucid dream, out-of-body experience. I use those terms relatively interchangeably. And basically, if I induce an out-of-body experience, I'll walk over to the counter, I'll randomly pick a card, and I'll see what the picture is. Very often, you don't see a picture that's one of the three literal things, but some image, okay?
Okay.
And I lock the image in my brain, and I basically go about my business. And then when I wake up, I say, okay, that was an interesting image. Which one does it map to? Is it a star? Is it a cross? Or is it, you know, squiggly lines? Which is closest? And I'll map it, and I'll go over to the real cards, which is still face down, of course. It's not a sleepwalking thing. It's nothing like that. And I'll basically see if I was right or wrong. Real simple. And I went through various iterations of this and various redefinitions. The last 27 times I did it, you would expect 9 hits out of 27. You know, it's 1/3 probability. You should get it right 1/3 of the time. I got it right 18 out of 27.
Wow.
Which if you look at the probability, and I've got a strong statistical background, and I could, you know, I'll show you the math if you're interested.
But sure, we can post that on the site if you'd like.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you model it as Bernoulli trials. It's not a big deal. And I wrote a little C code to do the calculations. Basically, hitting 18 out of 27 only has a probability of about 3 in 10,000. Hitting 18 or more out of 27 has a probability of about 4 out of 10,000. So does it prove anything? No. Does it strongly imply something? Yeah. Yeah, it does. And, you know, it implies that information from the real world is bleeding into the dream space, which, you know, we all kind of know. I mean, many people have had prophetic dreams and dreams that were almost beyond coincidence. And you go, wow, that was weird. But, you know, this is an attempt to use lucid dreaming to create a reproducible framework and to crunch some statistics and attempt to put a little science around it, if you will.
Well, in speaking about getting information from the dream state that might be relevant in the real world, can you speak a little bit about maybe communicating with dream characters and any sort of valuable information that they might be able to give you?
Wonderful topic. You know, dream characters have not been helpful to me. I've got some place to go with this that might be relevant to the question, but it's pretty rare that dream characters have meaningful information. I could think of one time where I'd gone up to my wife. I was lucid dreaming, and I walked upstairs to essentially my dream wife and was asking for her for insight about something. And I'm drawing my memory for the story. And, her response, I'd have to dig through my dream journal. Her response was interesting. And when I looked up the response the next day, there was, in fact, something, a company in Seattle that produced a tea that might have been interesting to the application. I wish I had the details. It's academic. But let me answer the question better. What I find interesting is really asking your dream space for information. And, you know, if you read, for instance, Robert Wagner, he's a big proponent of just asking questions out loud to your dream space and seeing what happens. Or, you know, if we go to the notion of a dream guide and what that all means, and we'll get into the force transference experiments momentarily. But when I was doing those, it was quite clear I was literally being pushed and pulled in certain directions that facilitated the experiment. I mean, quite literally.
Wow.
And that's, you know, your dream space or your supermind, you know, basically interacting and showing you something that it wants to show you. But, getting insights from dream characters has been a tough one for me. Very often, they're buffoons, unfortunately. much like a lot of other people who lucid dream, very, very often they're not too helpful.
Well, so can you give us an example of some questions that you have perhaps asked your dream space and that it's been able to help you?
You know, let me Let me give you what I think is the most profound example of a dream space interaction. And I'm going to tell the story slow, and hopefully it will make sense. When I was reading Monroe's work, and he wrote three books, and I was pretty close to finishing the trilogy. And I found his work interesting. I found there were a lot of parallels to my own. And obviously he was on my mind. So one day I had a non-lucid dream, and in this non-lucid dream, he pulled up in a brown Chevy hatchback from the 70s. And he pulled up with a friend of his, and they walked along my driveway, and I said hi, and they ignored me, and they climbed up on my garage roof and installed a satellite dish. And I basically woke up at that point, I want to say, and I thought, my, that's an interesting dream. You know, what's it trying to tell me? So basically, it dawned on me that, you know, Monroe is a technical guy, a satellite dish is a communication tool, right? That's what it is, sure, fundamentally. So in subsequent lucid dreams, and I could basically have out-of-body experiences where I replicate my real-world, you know, reality space and my immediate surroundings quite easily. So I basically, on a number of occasions, basically induced an out-of-body experience, climbed up to my garage or flew up to my garage and basically tried to leverage, you know, that path and the direction of the satellite. And I was taking it quite literally to try to get information, much like Monroe would use a click or tune into you know, somebody's ident, if that terminology is meaningful to you. I didn't get anything literal, but I got a totem pole with a bear on it, and then in a subsequent dream, a giant white rabbit, which is an interesting drug reference, I suppose. But I was talking about it, and I've got a friend on Mortal Mist where I'm quite active at discussing lucid dreams, and she's a Native American, and she suggested, well, you know, why don't you consider that symbolism as a potential dream guide, and, you know, look up what it means and see if you can, you know, reproduce the event and let that dream guide guide you, right? So, you know, I did that. I tried to reproduce that state and see if I could basically reproduce a bear dream guide. So, in fact, I did. It came over. It was quite friendly. I blurted out, you know, what's your name? And it didn't respond verbally. And I said, I will call you Little Brown One. And so I'll try to make a long story short. Little Brown ultimately runs to the backyard. I fly over the house to intercept him. And he's now not a big bear, but a little bear, and he's hurt. He's got, like, a scar in his stomach, and he's hurt. And basically, I help him and kneel down and basically help him back on his feet type of thing. And I woke up at that point, and it seemed obvious that, you know, there was a message there that seemed to say, you know, I need to work more synergistically with my dream space, not overpower it, but be sympathetic to it. I mean, that was my interpretation of the dream. I tried to conjure Little Brown One again. I did. He ran over to me. You know, we had an embrace. It was an interesting experience. A day or two later, I finished the Monroe trilogy, and here's the kicker of the story. And you could call it coincidence, or you could call it something more interesting. Toward the end of the trilogy, Monroe's talking about being at some kind of gate toward some powerful entity that was controlling, you know, the dream space. And, you know, he addressed Monroe, and he said, you know, we tend to call you Little One. You know, so basically, you know, days prior to finishing the book, I was referencing this dream guide as Little Brown One. And, you know, this all-powerful entity of the universe was referencing Robert Monroe as Little One. I mean, I find that way more than a coincidence.
Wow.
But, you know, I mean, chalk it up as such. But, I mean, it seems to imply to me that, you know, it's a message from Monroe, or an entity within its cluster manifesting as, you know, a bear, or perhaps some part of that cluster. I mean, there's different ways to interpret it, but I don't interpret it as a coincidence. Much like I don't interpret the Zenocard experiment as a coincidence, or the force transfer experiments. I mean, I believe in coincidence, but when you start to serialize these coincidences one after another, they're no longer a coincidence.
Sure. And actually, could you speak a little bit more about your force transfer experiments?
Yeah, absolutely. And probably now's a logical time to get into it. So The Zendikart experiment was interesting because you got information flowing from, you know, waking reality space to the dream space potentially, and I could tell you other stories and other predictions of the future and all, you know, all that stuff. I mean, I think a lot of people have those stories, but I tried to flip the problem around, which is to say, what if you could transfer force from the dream space into waking reality space? And the motive for that is, you know, the universe is bidirectional. Okay. And I would not be the first person to suggest that maybe the dream space has physicality. And if you get into theoretical physics, and I'm not a theoretical physicist, but, you know, arguably I know enough to be dangerous, so to speak. it's conjectured that there are upwards of 26 dimensions in our universe. And I would certainly not be the first person to suggest that maybe one's dream space is a projection into some set of dimensions that are outside of our four-dimensional space that we're dealing with right now. And so there's other conjectures that say, well, if you were an entity in a higher dimensional space, there's the potential to link that dimensional space into lower dimensional space, let's say our plane. And if force was traversing from one space to the other, there would be essentially a give and take, because Mother Nature seems to have set up the universe as, you know, getting into conservation of energy. You know, if you push, there's a pull, right? If energy is destroyed, energy is given off. It is this conservation of energy concept. And certainly the Zendikart experiments seem to suggest that information could flow into, you know, the dream space. So, you know, I tried to basically set up an experiment to show the reverse. I did it in the most obvious possible way. I put basically an electromagnetometer on the kitchen counter, like an EMF meter that, you know, people use in ghost hunting, things of that nature.
Okay.
And the intent was to try to get a positive response in that meter by inducing an out-of-body experience and walking over to the dream meter and mucking with it in some way and basically seeing if the meter changed in the real world via a video camera trained on it. So it's the reciprocal of the Zendikart experiment. What I got was not what I expected. I was kind of hoping for some positive spike in EMF. What I got was a reduction of EMF.
Really?
So, and you know, again, it's unfortunately, and, you know, there are places to go with this. I would have loved to have gotten something definitive as hell,
okay,
and something that was outside the bounds of statistical inference. But let's get into statistical inference. Basically, the needle on this thing would typically hover around 1.0, and it would kind of bounce around a little bit because of thermal noise in the op amp, and it would go down a little bit here and there. But on a good number of events, based on my interaction with it, time correlated to my interaction in the dream space, I was getting reductions in the position of the needle that were well outside its typical probability distribution. And I didn't try to model it. It's kind of academic. But the results were certainly at least as statistically interesting as the Zendikart experiment, and probably more so. Probably more so. On top of the ultimate conclusion that the meter itself broke.
Are you serious? That's great.
Well, you know, I was kidding with a friend of mine who I share some of my findings with, and I said I'm hesitant to try to break the other meter I've got, and he said I understand why that would be. You know, I think there are places to go with this, and, you know, make a long story short, I got diverted from these experiments based on a lot of the other things that seemed important to me in this exploratory process. And but there are obvious places to go with this. But, you know, what is required to even do these experiments in the first place? You need to have a propensity to have out-of-body experience. You need to have a propensity to create a dream space that is identical to your waking reality space and to leave out items in waking reality space that bleed into the dream space and you need to be able to interact or otherwise gain information from them. Very few people can do that. I could do it easily. But very few people can do it, and hence it becomes this quirky little. And I've talked about it. I don't know if anybody's tried to replicate it independently, but it becomes this quirky set of experiments that, you know, can be expanded upon. You know, maybe you could capture an electronic voice phenomenon, maybe you could capture you know, something else, and you know, there are places to go with it, and I will be there eventually.
Well, that's really interesting. Speaking about kind of having an out-of-body experience, in your experience, when you leave the body, how long is kind of, I don't know, the real world maintained? I know that Robert Bruce, which is kind of on a more New Agey side of this whole spectrum, but he has the theory of kind of a real time zone, so that when you project out of the body, you're sort of in a physical space, so to speak, or what your brain remembers as physical space. But then when you start to think of something, you kind of enter the dream reality. Is that something that you find too, or what have your experiences with that been?
My experiences are not radically different. When I have an out-of-body experience, I have a direct transition into my dream space, and it's a replica of my waking reality space. If I choose to stay in this space, I can. Or if I choose to change the dream space, I can. And I think really that's what you're driving at. And I've got a number of methods to change the dream space. And they become conceptual methods, really. One method is basically to walk over to a wall and, essentially melt the wall and open a portal and enter a different space. I mean, I can do that pretty consistently. Another method is to fly directly up and basically expect a different scene to manifest and fly around and expect a different scene to manifest and be looking for something in particular, a city, an ocean, something else. So it's pretty easy to leave, even if you begin your out-of-body experience in a space that's identical to waking reality space, it's pretty easy to change up the scene. Now, if you go into LaBerge's experiments where he proved in pretty reasonable terms that time, in the lucid dream space is flows similarly to the waking reality space. And he did that by simply having lucid dreamers count and give eye signals to people in the lab. And this seems to be a pretty nice correlation. And I was leveraging that finding in the force transfer experiments, for instance, to say, okay, if I just woke up from this experiment where I tried to transfer force, and I know this happened, 60 seconds ago in my dream space. Well, I'll wake up, I'll stop the camera, and I'll simply go back 90 seconds and see what happened 30 seconds later, right? So I'm leveraging that fact. Now, whether or not your perception of time flows differently if the dream space is not similar to this one, I don't know. I think your perception of time is probably somewhat tied to your conscious awareness, I guess would be my conjecture.
Okay. Have you ever had any experiences with other dreamers within the dream space?
The answer is no, which raises the only fundamental question I still struggle with. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. Again, if you like this model of the dream world being a projection into higher dimensional space, well, why is it so damn difficult to meet up with another dreamer to come out, right?
Right.
Well, I mean, apparently Mother Nature, if it is in fact possible, Mother Nature is not set up to make that easy. So, then becomes the question, are we simply projecting into different points along time and space where it becomes so unlikely that another dreamer would be there? I mean, that's one explanation. And another explanation is it's all in your mind, which I grow less and less fond of the notion that it's just all in your mind, that it has no physicality, that it's this meaningful visionary state. Of course, your brain is active when you're sleeping. I simply no longer believe that because of all my experiences. It would be an interesting experiment. I mean, if you were to design an experiment to try to prove this, I suppose you would need two lucid dreamers who were adept at out-of-body experience and projecting into their dream space such that it was a replica of your waking reality space. And they would need to basically go to sleep in the same room and try to be inducing an out-of-body experience at the same time and see what happens. I mean, I personally don't know of anybody who's ever taken a serious attempt at that. Maybe you do. I don't. But if you were to try to design an experiment to show that, I think you'd have to do something like that.
Say in your mind, say to yourself, I am more than my physical body.
So, have you had any experience with Monroe's focus states?
Yeah, and that's an excellent question and something that's really been extraordinarily interesting to me lately. I read Monroe's trilogy, and, you know, as fate would have it, boy, I would love to go to the Monroe Institute and take a week-long journey there and do the Gateway Experience. I would love to do that. And it's not an issue of money. It's an issue of time off and making that happen, which is the most unfortunate reason not to do it, I suppose. But I've conversed with people at the Institute a little bit on some of my findings, and they've been very helpful. But basically, I bought the Gateway series, and which you could buy on disc, and it's essentially 18 discs, and I simply worked through it one 30-minute exercise at a time, and I wanted to see what it was about. I was sufficiently intrigued by Monroe's findings. And, you know, as I started to get into it, it dawned on me that, you know, isn't it interesting that these focus states, and the higher the number, the deeper the dissociative state, basically. Isn't it interesting that these focus states have, you know, feel a lot like, you know, a salvia-induced dissociative state? I mean, it was pretty clear that there was a synergy between those two. And I started to feel like, you know, that there, you know, as I made my way up the focus states, it would become more and more familiar. Right, because I've used salvia responsibly many, many times, and I know what that's like. And I was expecting to get to some familiar state. And you know, expectation is a funny thing. And you know, you could easily claim that expectation, you know, will form a conclusion, and so be it. But you know, I made my way through the Gateway series, and it was a wonderful experience. And I would suggest it to anybody who's interested in that work and really exploring points along the consciousness continuum. It wasn't until I said, well, I wonder what's next, that, you know, the kicker here kind of struck me. So, you know, basically the Gateway Experience brings you up to Focus 21. And I forget precisely how they define that. I'd have to take a peek at my CDs sitting next to me, but it's academic. You know, basically as you go higher up that ladder, Focus 23 is supposed to be a place where people who departed from the earth, you know, basically still believe they caught up in the earthly experience and they're confused. Focus 27 is supposed to be kind of a way station where you go to die, and it's this pleasant experience, and it's a transitionary, easy, get used to the notion that you're dead sort of state. And, you know, I mean, call it what it is, right? And so basically, you know, I did a little research, and the only way you could get to Focus 27 with CDs that were produced by the Monroe Institute is by buying a set of exercises called Going Home. And the intention of Going Home is basically to explore the consciousness continuum in preparation for death, and to understand that you're more than your physical body and what might happen when you die, basically. And it takes you to Focus 27, and supposedly, you know, it's kind of like the Focus 27 state is like a park, essentially. And, you know, there's grass, and there's trees, and there's sidewalks, and people milling about, and there's people bicycling, and that's what the state's supposed to be. It's a nice, easy, transitional, feel-good state. And, you know, I got to Focus 27, and, you know, by doing the exercises, and certainly I had some visionary states in that regard. And finally, the kicker dawns on me, much like that little brown one story. I've been here before, and I've been here many times before. And basically, I've been here via, you know, salvia-induced visions. And did you catch that link to Arrowhead I sent you a couple hours ago, by any chance?
No. What was the link to Arrowhead?
Yeah. I've only posted one thing on Arrowhead in my life, and I think it's a great site, but I haven't been very active there. And so it dawns on me that I've been to this Focus 27 state many times, and I've been there via, you know, Sally's help, basically. And when I first started to experiment, I remember this one of the most intense visionary states I've ever had. And in this state, basically, I found myself in a field, a park, with grass and trees and bike paths and people milling about, and the whole thing. Identical to what Monroe describes, even though it was years before I was even aware of what Monroe was doing, you know, 3-4 years. And I was in this park, and I was looking around, and I find myself in kind of a disembodied state. I don't have a physical body. in that visionary state. But there's a visionary field, and you know, you're seeing something, right? And I remember the periphery kind of starting to vibrate, and I basically started to get pulled back, and I traveled backwards, and basically I traveled backwards such that this field became nothing more than I would describe kind of a landing pad or this, you know, this big chunk of dirt with a park on top of it. And as I got pulled back further and further, this park had this cone on the bottom of it, which funneled down to the head of a person. And basically there were two other cones leading out in different directions to other pieces of earth or other, you know, realities, so to speak. But the point really is, which, you know, you can interpret in a lot of different ways, and I'll leave that to the interested party. But you know, really, when you get into these focus states, and you know, you get into focus 27, which is this way station for the, you know, the recently departed, or you get into the notion of a focus state associated with an eye there cluster, and you get into, you know, rings around the earth that are, you know, different visionary states and points along the consciousness continuum. You know, I am fairly convinced that salviative and worm is basically opening up visionary paths to those focus states. I mean, you know, they're all dissociative states that allow the brain to tune to other realities that are natural to the human brain, but are not normal to our ordinary process. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. That absolutely makes sense. And I've got a question for you. Do you feel that salvia and other entheogens have some kind of higher consciousness plant sentience, or is that just something we're putting on them?
I believe they're here for a purpose. I believe they are teacher plants, and I believe they're here to open up our consciousness and awareness and help explore the nature of the mind. I think there's very much something to that. And again, my justification is, you know, as I dig into experiences, and, you know, I'm not one to let it alone. You know, I'm not one to be content with what I've experienced. I'm always thinking, well, isn't it interesting I experienced that? Maybe I should try this. And that has nothing to do with drugs or anything like that. It's more the concept of what have I been shown and where am I going with it? But you know, to your point, entheogens are facilitating that. And you know, I go back to an original point I made 15, 20 minutes ago. You know, it's not just about science. It's not just about entheogens and shamanism. It's not just about Eastern philosophy. It's not just about Western philosophy. I firmly believe that there's this convergence problem or convergence challenge, where, you know, as people are able to cherry pick and negotiate all those different states, there are lessons to be gleaned and lessons to be learned. And I feel it would point somebody who could operate in all those different dimensions in a direction. And that's what's interesting to me, fundamentally.
Absolutely. Well, let's see here. And I've got one more question for you here. And this is one that we had talked to, or that you had sent us earlier to maybe speak about. So what, in your words, what would be the possible reason for contact from one's eye cluster?
Yeah, you know, and again, I'm trying to make sense out of my experiences too. You know, I can't claim that I fully understand it. I can't claim that it's nothing more than a whole bunch of coincidences. I can't make that claim. I don't think it is, and I think there's meaning, and I think it's pointing me in a direction. You know, I had that weird story with the little brown one, which seemed to have its own implications, and I've got a number of other experiences, which it becomes academic, we can get into it, where I believe I've been introduced to, if even momentarily, to other members of what might be my eye there cluster. And the point seems to me to be, and Monroe alludes to this, there seems to be this need to collect the eye there cluster and essentially break the pattern of earthly existence. And that's a big statement. And, you know, but, you know, again, it's not For somebody who hasn't studied different genres and different theories, it probably sounds insane, and that's fine. But, you know, again, going back to Tibetan Dream Yoga, it's not that far from what they're proposing, and they've studied the human mind for thousands of years.
Okay? That's true.
And you have to respect, you know, people who have sequestered themselves and studied the human mind for thousands of years, and they really believe the point to your earthly existence is to break the pattern. Right.
Yeah.
And so if there's a pattern of earthly existence and you are tied to a number of entities who, you know, have a dependency on you, well, maybe breaking the earthly existence in part depends on garnering insights and motivation from the other members of the cluster. And to me, that makes a lot of sense. You know, and again, it goes to there's a member of Mortal Mist who talks about this, and he says that, you know, having these sort of experiences seems to be all about a trickle of insight, a trickle of motivation, enough to keep you interested, to get you, you know, along this path where you understand. And I believe I'm somewhere along that path. I don't know if I'm 10% in, 90% in. I don't know what's left. If you draw parallels with Monroe. I'm not sure he was fully convinced that he had walked that path over 30 years of exploration. You know, I think there's a lot left.
Yeah. So what is next for Dr. Technical?
You know, there's the scientist in me, that wants to get back into the force transference experiments. And there's a number of ways I can and will do that. But again, I've been quite distracted by this notion because of a number of very extraordinary experiences with regard to basically meeting other members of the cluster. I'm fairly convinced I've done that, and I'm fairly convinced that there are lessons to be learned from that. That is a mighty powerful experience. Maybe it's something I'm making up, or maybe it's real. And I can assure you, regardless, it's a powerful experience, and it's something that is motivational. And that's where I've been spending time. And, you know, so, if you read my article on Mortal Mist, I've come to the conclusion that I'm best off leaving my motivation and my inspiration to my experiences. I don't want to overthink it. I want to have experiences. I want to, you know, be led down a certain breadcrumb trail, because that breadcrumb trail apparently has been laid along, you know, all along, and it's been productive. So I don't want to overpower the breadcrumb trail, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. That absolutely makes sense. Well, Dr. Technical, thank you so much for speaking with us. If anyone wanted to get in touch with you, it seems like you hang out at mortalmist.com. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, that's the best place. You know, Mortal Mist, I'll give you the summary there. It's probably not a great place to talk about salvia and entheogens and all that. A wonderful place to talk about lucid dream and out-of-body experience and what it means. I think Mortal Mist differentiates itself with regard to the maturity of the members there. We're both some of the most fantastic lucid dreamers and some of the most insightful people. It's friendly, it's non-controversial, and you will find me there. Unlike certain other lucid dream sites, which boast a lot more members and there's a lot more drama, it's not about drama. It's about lucid dreaming and what it all might mean. So that's a fantastic place to contact me. And, you know, if some of the things I mentioned are interesting, you will find me there. I basically head up what's called the Research Guild there, which kind of explores some of these more insightful, intense questions as to what it might all mean. And I'm open to people who have ideas and want to build experiments and really want to try to formulate that bigger question of what does it mean?
Is there anything that we didn't get to talk about that you really want to speak about before we go here?
No, I think that sums it up quite well, guys.
All right. Hey, thank you so much for doing this interview with us. We really, really appreciate it.
Excellent. And I enjoyed it, and hopefully it'll be of interest to your members. And, you know, I was poking around your site, and I think it's very cool what you guys are doing. And, you know, it's lending its own contribution. So that's very cool.
Yeah, and you know, and for I Am Ubermensch, anybody can submit an interview. So if you want to become the Ubermensch and interview someone else that you think is interesting, by all means do it, and you can submit it to the podcast, and we will absolutely post it.
Yeah, very cool. So I will keep that in mind, and I've enjoyed the discussion, guys.
All right, hey, thank you so much.
So that was our podcast, and I hope you enjoyed it. If you are capable of supporting us, please visit our website at taileaters.com and support our Patreon page there. And if not, we will continue to be working hard to produce you some good content that hopefully you can learn from interesting people from around the world. Until next time, happy dreaming.